completed. There's no agents.
Oh, there's no agents?
Okay. There are folks in the back of the room, if you could keep it quiet as you file out. Hello. The people in the back of the room, if you could keep it quiet as you file out, please. We're going to bring the meeting to somewhat of an order here. We haven't got a quorum yet, so we won't proceed with the minutes. Are the people here for the House File 1001? All righty, they're ready to go then. All right, now it looks like we might have a quorum here. You want to take the attendance?
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery.
Here.
Gauthier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty. Johnson.
Here.
Kelly. Kiefer. Kreisel. Leidiger. Mariani. McDonald. Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum.
Present.
Smith.
Here.
Okay, and we'll bring the meeting officially to order. Public Safety Policy and Finance, and somebody want to offer a motion to accept the minutes from the 15th?
So moved.
Representative Smith moves the minutes of March 15th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. Today we have, we're going to tinker around with the order of appearance here, and we're going to put up 1001, House File 1001, Representative Woodard bill. Are you ready to move your bill?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1001 and recommend that it be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, you folks have heard the motion by Representative Woodard on House File 1001, and are you ready to bring up your testifiers? You want any opening comments, or is there any amendments?
There are no amendments, Mr. Chair, but just a quick overview of this particular bill. The Organized Retail Crime Bill tries to address some large-scale criminal operations that occur within retailers. I have a lot of personal background on this particular issue. I spent 13 years with the Target Corporation in their Assets Protection Group and worked on many teams that tried to address organized retail crime, and I'll tell you, this is a bill and a law that is certainly well overdue. These aren't the mom and pop shoplifters that you may think in your head, that you know, the one-time shoplifters, the 16-year-old kids. These are organized groups who have realized they can make a lot of money when they organize their shoplifting rings and you know, really do target some of the best retailers we have here in the state, as well as smaller retailers. And there's some really sad stories that come out of these kinds of retail crimes where they're stealing baby formula and re-dating that baby formula and having it resold at other stores. These are bad people, and this bill attempts to address that through a little, one, defining what it is, and then two, for stronger penalties. So based on that, I'd like to call the testifiers.
Hey, while the testifiers coming up, just an announcement for the committee that I treasure my lunch hour. We will be quitting promptly at noon. We do have time scheduled tonight, but the longer questions and the longer answers will determine whether we're coming back tonight. It would be nice to get through with the bills. And the testifiers on all these bills, if you bring number of people up here, it would be appreciated if you didn't give redundant testimony from everybody that appears. If one has already said it, the other one could probably just stay in their seat, but that's up to you. And it would make us look more favorably on your bill. So...
On that note, thank you.
All right, go ahead. Thank you. You can go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Poole, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. We are a state trade association in the state since 1897. We represent over 200 retail members with 1,100 stores statewide, as well as 100 distributors and manufacturers. Our member companies employ over 125,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. In this challenging economy, grocers work diligently to make every penny count. This allows us to bring the greatest value to Minnesotans for every dollar they spend. Every senseless cost that a grocer is forced to absorb makes it more and more difficult to keep prices in line for our customers. That is why the Minnesota Grocers Association is here in support of House File 1001. Organized retail crime is one of the fastest growing security problems facing the retail community, costing tens of billions of dollars annually per FMIS for FBI estimates. These crimes ultimately lead to inflated prices for consumers and lost sales tax revenue for the state. This crime alone cost the state over $30 million in lost tax revenue. The items frequently targeted by these groups are small, expensive household items such as over-the-counter drugs, baby formula, razors, batteries, all of which are commonly sold in all of your community grocery stores, affecting owners large and small all across the state. After these products have been stolen by these professional shoplifters or boosters, they are resold on the internet through fencing operations or flea markets. This is very different than petty shoplifting and presents a potential hazard to consumers. Grocers and manufacturers take very seriously the integrity of the products that they make and sell. This unscrupulous way of selling stolen products can result in package tampering, altered expiration dates, creates dangerous and compromised products for consumers. We work closely with our local law enforcement agencies to put all the appropriate measures in place to reduce risk and create a safer shopping experience. We also have extensive in-house training and education of staff. But it is simply not enough to combat a problem of this magnitude. 24 other states have already passed legislation similar to help combat this growing problem. As Representative Woodard explained, this bill does three things that give law enforcement more tools to fight ORC. It creates organized retail crime as a crime defined as two or more people working together to steal over $1,000 in merchandise over a 90-day period with the intent to resell products. It adds felony theft to the list of crimes that could trigger the racketeering statute. This provision allows law enforcement to get after ringleaders of these sophisticated crimes. Finally, to pay for all of this, ORC crimes are added to the forfeiture laws, allowing the state to recoup some costs of enforcing these laws. Many of these criminals go to multiple stores all across the state, stealing items to stay underneath the state thresholds for theft. Today, more than ever, we do need to address the serious nature of organized retail crime. It affects all retailers, large and small, across the state. Everyone is a victim. I do have an example of a Polk County, Florida ring. It's a ring of 13 suspects who operate an extensive organized retail crime. This took place as two men went into stores while drivers waited outside. In the store, the men would meet with two females. One of the men would fill a shopping cart with baby formula, then walk away, while the other men acted as a lookout. The women would fill oversized ladies' bags with formula and leave the store. By rotating the women, many cans of baby formula were stolen. All of this took place over the course of 15 minutes. These criminals would then take the baby formula to a storage unit. Once they had a large enough amount, they would notify the next level fence, called the upper level fence, who would remove the formula from the state and sell it. In this case, 21 arrests were made, and it is estimated that in 1 year, this single group stole $2.5 million worth of baby formula. And that, over a 7-year lifespan of this crime ring, was $17.5 million worth of formula. This formula was obviously not kept dry or in cool conditions as required to improve to preserve the integrity. It is likely the product was sold to low-income mothers who unknowingly fed a tainted product to their newborns. While this particular example is in Florida, it's important to note that the suspects were based out of Atlanta and were very mobile. This is a huge crime enterprise with far-reaching hands, especially in today's society with the increased access to the internet. In closing, the Minnesota Grocers Association believes this committee can do a great service to Minnesotans by supporting this legislation that recognizes organized retail crimes hurts consumers, careers, and community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Representative, Johnson first, and then Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is testimony completed then, Representative Woodard, pretty much?
No, Mr. Chair, we've got two more testifiers.
I could wait till the end.
Okay. How about you? Okay, we'll wait. Morning, ma'am. If you could state your name and title and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Fernholz, and I'm with the Minnesota Retailers Association. The Minnesota Retailers Association supports this legislation that could drastically reduce organized retail crime and protect consumers here in the state of Minnesota. As you've heard, organized retail crime is one of the most pressing security problems for retailers. Organized retail crime harms small and large businesses alike in both the metro area and in greater Minnesota. The National Retail Federation survey indicates that 90% of retailers nationwide reported being victims of organized retail crime in 2010. Many of the smaller retailers don't realize this is happening until they perform their yearly audits at the end of the year. As already stated, 24 states have enacted legislation to deter organized retail crime. 10 more states have pending legislation. The Minnesota Retailers Association supports this legislation that would deter organized retail crime rings from operating here in the state of Minnesota and strengthen the organized retail crime prosecution tools. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, ma'am.
We have one more testifier, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sean Shaughnessy, and I'm the investigations team leader for Target here in Minnesota. Thank you for conducting this hearing today on the proposed organized retail crime bill. Here in Minnesota, we experience organized retail crime issues like the rest of the country. Much of the theft we see involves infant formula, razor blades, and other health and beauty items, video games, DVDs, and other expensive electronics. These items are stolen because they present quick resale value, whether it's at a pawn shop or through an internet auction site. The individuals involved with this activity often steal to support criminal enterprises such as drugs, weapons, or gang activity. And I would like to illustrate or share with you a local case that was here in Minnesota just a few years ago. Target's double deal investigation involved a business engaged in a criminal enterprise with over 150 boosters selling brand new merchandise stolen from retailers in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, California, New York, North Dakota, and Missouri. Boosters obtained stolen merchandise through thefts utilizing professional shoplifting tools, check and credit fraud schemes. The business then sold the merchandise on eBay and other online sites representing itself as legitimate wholesaler of media products. Target investigators were notified of the business practices through interviews of professional boosters apprehended at Target stores throughout 2002 to 2005. Target investigators approached local law enforcement regarding the business on multiple occasions. During that time frame, local law enforcement met with the business owners several times explaining they should stop buying new product from these individuals. In May 2006, local law enforcement contacted Target investigators. Their agency had obtained intelligence that the business was continuing to buy new product from boosters. Target investigators conducted mobile surveillance of these professional booster crews that were selling to the business in order to establish that the product was stolen and develop informants who conducted controlled sales to the business using merchandise provided by Target. During these sales, the business requested specific merchandise, paying roughly 15% of the retail value for the merchandise they later sold at wholesale and near retail prices. As you can see by the link chart provided, some of these booster crews or cells stole and sold millions of dollars of product from retail establishments and were paid in excess of hundreds of thousands of dollars. In 2007, federal inspectors from the United States Postal Service worked steadily to coordinate the investigation with multiple retailers and agencies. In September 2007, search warrants produced over $250,000 in stolen merchandise seized from the business. Target's forensics lab in Minneapolis was used to examine seized computers and quantify the dollars and relationships between cells, which is illustrated on the link chart. Retail industry losses are estimated at $11 million over 4 years, with lost sales tax of over $700,000. State organized retail crime legislation would assist us in preventing these crimes from occurring, allow our partners to hold the professional boosters and fences appropriately accountable for their crimes, while increasing the amount of revenue and sales tax that would be otherwise lost to these types of criminal syndicates. We appreciate the work that has been done to draft this bill, making Minnesota a partner with retailers in the fight against this growing problem. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my testimony, and I thank you for allowing us to participate. I invite any questions.
Thank you very much. Members, we go back to our list. Representative Johnson, Mullery, and Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess to the author, I'm all for cracking down on organized retail theft crime, but I also worked with criminals for a lot of years, and what I'm wondering with this bill is how would you distinguish between an organized retail crime outfit, as we've heard in testimony here, and two guys with a drug habit that stole a $1,200 TV from Target? So with those, because the way I read the bill, those two guys would then be subject to the same kind of consequence, which to me would be overkill for what their situation is. Any thoughts on how the bill would address that kind of, you understand what I'm saying?
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. I do. I understand what you're saying. Of course, the prosecutor will still have leeway in those particular cases to decide whether or not it rises to the level of this. The bill attempts to address that by talking about the fact that they would conspire to do that. So in your case, yes, meth addicts who conspire together to steal over $1,000 would be considered potentially prosecutable under this statute.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that gives me some pause. The other question I have is, how did you determine that $1,000 figure? Any particular reason?
Representative Woodard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that was done in collaboration with the Minnesota Retailers Association and victims of this crime. Direct victims of this crime. Obviously, the entire state is a victim of this crime when it comes to sales tax revenue, when it comes to criminal elements operating in the state from other states because they come here knowing that we don't have an organized retail theft statute. So that was in collaboration with those parties.
Okay, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Woodard, you weren't here, but Representative Smith is, and as I recall, I thought you carried a bill to raise just the mere felony to $1,000. And I'd ask Representative Smith, because he's probably, or Mr. Diebel, didn't that pass into law a couple years ago? Maybe one of you two probably would remember. Yes, I'm being pointed out 609.52 subdivision 3A. I think that became law.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, you're in the right section, Representative Mullery, with the sentence based on the thresholds to get to a felony level theft. And so the under clause 3 of 609.52. For $10,000 or 5-year felony, you have to have a value of the property or services stolen is more than $1,000, but not more than $5,000.
Thank you. And it was Ms. Weeks that came up with it, not me. I guess I understand the huge seriousness of what you're getting at. I think you are covering a little too much. I think in the present form, I couldn't recommend it, but I really want to get at this problem, and I think we probably have huge loopholes. What I'm worried about is, for instance, under subdivision section 2, subdivision 2, the number 1 agrees with another person to participate in. That could be even a criminal's wife or a girlfriend that they're living with could know about it and just not tip off somebody about it, and that would be participating in because it's held in their house. And I think that we're going too far when we're including that type of thing. It could be a parent of an adult child. who doesn't have much control over that parent but is agreeing, in essence, to that. And with regard to your statement, Representative Woodard, you haven't been here long enough, but my very first year, I remember raising a problem on a bill and saying this could be prosecuted, a certain situation, and the county attorney said, oh, no, nobody would ever prosecute that. Well, within 6 months, it was prosecuted. And I've seen that over the years here. Often it's not even a year before somebody says or actually prosecute something that they said wasn't going to be prosecuted. In the same way, I'm not sure under number two, just I'm a little worried how broadly that captures people. I just think that right now this isn't ready for signature to go into law, and I think we have to create exemptions or narrow it down so that I definitely want to get at the big rings that you're going after. I just don't want to pick up the things, and also that what Representative Johnson mentioned is a very big concern to me, because there's attic, there's different things like that going on. So I hope we can work with you, as this apparently is probably going to Representative Smith's committee. I think this would not be ready for law, but I think that we have to put something like this into law.
Did you want to respond?
Yes. Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, a couple of things. One is that certainly willing to work with you, because you do understand the intent of the law, and certainly am willing to work with you to tighten up some areas that may be of concern with you. I don't think it captures too many individuals, because, one, they would have to participate in the conduct constituting theft, and we can certainly, if Mr. Diebel wants to address that on exactly what that means from a statutory standpoint, but also that, they have to do it with the intent to resell or reenter the retail property and commerce for consideration. So going back to Representative Johnson's idea that, you've got a couple of meth addicts who are stealing this. If they were stealing it to watch TV, that would not that would not be on here. But certainly if they were going to intend to resell. And I don't know, Mr. O'Shaughnessy, did you want to add anything to that?
I think with the agreement, with the intent to resell it into the marketplace is the biggest business problem we see. It's, as you mentioned earlier, it's people acting in unison with one another who have a plan and are engaged in going and stealing it and then reintroducing it into the marketplace.
And Representative Mulray, I also did want to thank you for the compliment that I haven't been here that long.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up,
okay, Representative Mulray,
very quickly, I understand what you're saying, and that's what I was worried about. So I think we definitely have to narrow this down before it becomes law. I think Representative Johnson and I both have concerns about its broadness, but we definitely want something put into the law so we can go after the big operations.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Mr. Shaughnessy. You are a cop with Target?
Investigation team lead with Target, yes.
That's not a bad thing. I'm complimenting you. How long have you been doing that?
I've been with Target for 14 years.
Mr. Shaughnessy, I'm looking at a bill analysis, and I think I may have two questions here. And it gives an example of the retail theft in the area of infant formula, which Target carries, I presume. And it references an article from Loss Prevention Magazine, January issue 2005. And it suggests that there's two outlets for this stolen and fenced infant formula, or I should say the profits from the sale of it. And one problem they report is that the infant formula is improperly stored, then it's relabeled, and so there would be a obvious health issue for the baby consuming it. Are you familiar with any heart, and I don't want to hear the heart examples, but has that happened that you're aware of?
Yes, it has.
It also lists in this bill analysis, and I'm going to read from it, it says, quote, in some cases, the profits from the illicit wholesalers were being funneled to Middle Eastern terrorist groups, unquote. Is that the case?
Mr. Shaughnessy?
I have heard of that occurring in the past, yes.
Representative Smith.
So so there's a health hazard for babies, and there are illegal profits going to terrorist groups. That's a couple of hard things that the author is seeking to, besides the theft, seeking to cure. Is that correct?
Mr. Shaughnessy or Representative Woodard?
That's correct, Representative Smith. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any more testifiers? Anybody in the crowd want to speak in opposition of the bill? Any closing comments? Representative Johnson, go ahead.
I think, Chair Cornish, and just lastly, is there a fiscal note for this prepared yet?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, there is a request for a fiscal note I checked this morning that has not been completed. In fact, no agency has responded yet on it.
Okay. No more comments. Closing comments from the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the comments today in committee here. We will work to make sure that we've got the bill in the proper order and make sure that some of your concerns are met there. Also, I would just like to point out that retailers not only are losing money here from the theft standpoint, they also do run, as Representative Smith indicated, very professional organizations that really do all of the back work here, or all the backbone here to these investigations are done by the retailers themselves and handed over to law enforcement in a nice package. So I would like to commend them as well for doing that. This is not an ask from the retailers that we get more law enforcement resources for them. They really already do a lot of that in a very professional manner, and so I appreciate that.
Okay. And with that, you'd like to restate your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to renew the motion that House File 1001 be passed by this committee and re-referred to the House Judiciary Committee.
Okay, you've all heard the motion. Any comment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you very much for your bill. And Mr. Shaughnessy, you can go back to work and catch those bad guys.
Thank you. All right.
Okay, we have an announcement that the 11th and 12th grade students from St. Anthony Village High School are here participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People, your role in Minnesota government tour and educational programs. So if we could give them a hand for being here. And with that, what's up? House File 642, Representative Slocum, are you ready? Representative Slocum, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 642. How do you want this to go?
Where's it going?
Later.
We'll lay it over for
possible inclusion.
Okay. Representative Slocum moves her bill to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Slocum, go ahead with your presentation.
This bill is fairly self-explanatory. We've talked in committee about research that says that housing a juvenile with adults means essentially that juvenile will remain in the criminal justice system probably for the rest of their lives, and being rather expensive and detrimental to society. This bill says that a child certified to adult court would be detained pending the outcome of criminal proceedings in a secure juvenile facility rather than an adult detention facility, keeping the juvenile separate from the adults. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. I have two testifiers. I also want to say there is a small fiscal impact locally that I didn't have last time, and I think can our fiscal staff talk about that a little bit, please?
Oh, Mr. Carter.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, there is no state impact to this bill. Fiscal note states that there could be an impact to local resources for housing some of these individuals, but it doesn't give a cost.
Okay. Representative Walker, we heard this bill in Judiciary?
In Judiciary, and it passed unanimously, bipartisan.
Okay. Yes, Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Representative Slocum for being such a sharp reviewer of the statutes and catching what my bill last year was intended to, but once the department got a hold of it and changed the language, they left this part out. So Representative Slocum is really reading the statutes carefully to make sure we get things done right.
Thank you, okay. Representative Mulry. I have two testifiers, and I have a letter from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association in the pages.
Okay. Representative Slocum, I don't think your bill is controversial. It probably has support. You could have your testifiers come up, but if you want to instruct them to be very short in their presentations, that would be great.
In anticipation of that, I already have.
What's that?
Mr. Chair, in anticipation of brevity, I already have instructed them.
Okay.
I have Captain Mike Resch from the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office and Jim Grathwall from Minneapolis Public Schools.
Okay, if you would approach the stand there and table and identify yourself and begin.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Captain Mike Resch of the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office. I'm the facility commander of the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office Jail. I would like to thank Linda Slocum for taking the leadership of this important issue.
Where is that?
The jail is an 839-bed facility staffed and designed to detain individuals 18 years of age and older. Our jail is the only American Corrections Association accredited facility in the state and has an average daily population of 685 inmates, majority adults who are awaiting trial or sentencing. In 2010, we housed an average of 6 youthful offenders in the jail at any given time. Under current rules and regulations, when a juvenile is certified to stand trial as an adult, the juvenile is required to be kept in our jail, in our adult jail, until they face trial and sentencing. House File 642 will allow judges and sheriffs the ability to house the juvenile offenders in a juvenile facility pending their trial and adjudication. This would allow us to better manage our facility and improve efficiency while maintaining public safety. Let me briefly explain why. The American Corrections Association is an organization nationally recognized for identification of best practices in detention and corrections. According to the ACA, youthful offenders housed in adult jails should be afforded specialized accommodations and services, including sight and sound separation from adult inmates, direct supervision in housing units, classification and programming plans to account for the physical, mental, social, and educational needs of youthful offenders, specialized training for program staff who work with the youthful offenders, case management plans, food service, the daily nutritional requirements needed over the adults, and medical issues involving parents or guardians. The Sheriff's Office Jail currently provides specialized accommodations and services to its youthful offenders, but as mentioned above, it comes with undue burden, both financially and operationally, to the Sheriff's Office. Additionally, a recent federal court case requires the local school district to provide teachers and educational opportunities to juvenile offenders who are being held in the adult jail. Providing for educational needs of youthful offenders in the jail is particularly costly and operationally difficult. Currently, high school classes are provided to the youthful offenders in the jail by the Minneapolis School District Stadium View. In 2010, the Sheriff's Office resorted to using office space as classrooms to conduct these classes. Simply because youthful offenders are being prosecuted as adults does not detract from the fact that they are still under 18 years of age. Rules, laws, and standards for the detention of youthful offenders are significantly different from those for adult offenders 18 and over. The level of socialization of youthful offenders while in the jail is greatly restricted. Youthful offenders in the jail are here for only serious felonies, and as a result, their length of stay is often measured time in months. It is not uncommon for a youthful offender to have one or two other inmates to interact with during their stay in the jail. Female youthful offenders are even more impacted. It's extremely rare that the sheriff's office detains more than one female youthful offender at any given time, resulting in that one female youthful offender being segregated with virtually no opportunities for socialization at all. Again, in passing this legislation, judges and sheriffs will have the ability to house these youthful offenders awaiting trial in a juvenile facility in a more efficient way. In Hennepin County, the 123-bed juvenile facility is operated by Hennepin County Department of Community Corrections and Rehabilitation. The juvenile center, just one block west of the Metrodome, is designed to provide for the services and accommodation needed for youthful offenders and has the resources to appropriately provide for their needs. In the juvenile center, the offenders can be served by one set of teachers and escorted throughout the building without the restrictions in place they would have in an adult jail due to safety and security concerns and welfare of the juvenile. This bill will offer judges and sheriffs the flexibility to house most of these juvenile prisoners who have been certified as adults in a juvenile facility. Juveniles housed with juveniles, adults housed with adults. This does not mean the juvenile cannot be housed in the adult jail. It means it provides administrators the flexibility to provide most of the offenders with adequate and safe housing, education, and programming without having to provide duplicate services just a few blocks away. The legislation will create more efficient overall operation and provide the needs for the youthful offenders. We, both the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, ask for your support. Thanks for your time.
Sir.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Grafthal.
Brief comments.
With the Minneapolis Public Schools, we strongly support the bill. We think it's better for students educationally, socially, correctionally, and it's more effective and efficient for the Minneapolis Public Schools to run an education program in this manner. Thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, both of you, and Representative Slocum, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Grafthal for the great testimony. Kept it under 30 seconds.
Any questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Slocum, would you like to do any closing?
Please vote for this. You're not voting for it. Please include this in the omnibus bill. It's a good bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Slocum, and the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you much, all of you. Okay, Representative McDonald.
Good morning, Chairman.
Good
committee
morning.
Members.
Are you ready to move your bill?
I am. I'd like to move my bill, House File 660.
To be laid over for possible inclusion?
That is correct.
Okay, your bill is in front of us, and Representative McDonald, would you like the opening remarks or go right into your testifying?
I'll just quickly go into some key talking points regarding 660. What this bill will do is reinstate a minimum 36-month presumptive sentence for offenders who receive repeat convictions of fourth, third, second, and first-degree criminal assault, sexual assault. But the problem was that in 2005, the legislature enacted laws to create life sentences for some sex offenders and impose harsher sentences on repeat offenders. When the sentencing guidelines to implement the changes made in 2005 were enacted for 2006, the key 36-month mandatory minimum for repeat offenders was repealed. This is not a good thing. It appears that the repeal was unintended. However, it has created a gap in which some offenders who have received a repeat conviction, particularly those who commit fourth and third degree offenses, which is horrible, do not receive as harsh a sentence as they deserve or have prior to that change of 2006. So what this bill does with the language in 660, it reinstates that very language that existed in the Minnesota statute, subdivision 2, prior to 2006 repeal. A fiscal note has been requested, and just briefly, the fiscal note projects no impact for 2012 and a two-bed fiscal impact for 2013. It also projects a bed impact to grow to by six per year for 2015. So this was in law before. It's a good bill because, of course, it reinstates the presumptive sentencing for those folks who have committed such horrendous crimes. And unfortunately, the legislature didn't intend this to be repealed. I do have some testifiers here with me, and they will be brief. They worked with me on this bill. We already were in front of the Judiciary Committee, and that at that point, I think Representative Smith, it was recommended to this committee. So with me today is Carolyn Palmer. She is with the MnCASA, staff attorney, and then Jill Payne, who is the interim executive director for the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commissions, and they know that brevity is necessary today.
Ms. Palmer, would you like to begin? State your name and title.
Thank you, Chair Cornish. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We are a nonprofit organization, and we represent about 70 sexual assault advocacy programs statewide, and we do support this bill today. I will just give some brief comments. Basically, we work with a number of county attorney offices around Minnesota to support their efforts to prosecute criminal sexual conduct crimes. These prosecutors, MnCASA's Public Policy Committee, and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association have consistently supported restoring the 36-month presumptive executed sentence as a necessary tool for addressing the repeat sex offenders they see in their courtrooms. As Representative McDonald noted, this provision did exist a few years ago, but was repealed in 2006. Over the past several years, MnCASA has worked with legislators trying to address a mistake that could have been easily remedied at the time it was made had it been noticed. Just to give a little bit of background, over the past 4 years, previous versions of this bill have passed committees in both the House and Senate without controversy. The only barrier we have faced in moving the bill toward law has been a relatively small fiscal note. When we first brought this legislation forward in 2007, there probably should not have been a fiscal impact assigned because no adjustment was made in the Department of Corrections budget to reflect the repeal of 36-month presumptive sentencing. Nobody recognized that it happened. However, as more time has passed, the appropriated funding was absorbed into the corrections-based budget, and now the restoration of this particular sentencing guideline results in a new bed count. And we would like to acknowledge Representative Lesh's assistance in obtaining that information about the bill's fiscal impact from DOC. So while we do recognize that any financial consequence is an important consideration now, we do believe this is an instance in which a small investment will make a big difference in how the state responds to repeat sex offenders. And at this point, I'd like to turn over the testimony to Jill Payne. She's a research and analyst with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and she will explain the mechanics of this bill proposal. Thank you.
Hey, Ms. Payne, if you give your name and title, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jill Payne. I'm a research analyst with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and while the agency has no official position on House File 660, the bill is consistent with how the commission treats repeat sex offenders. In 2006, the Guidelines Commission adopted a sex offender grid, which moved all sex offenders off the traditional grid. And with public safety as its primary goal, the new sex offender grid imposes harsher sentences on repeat sex offenders. Now, between 2007 and 2009, there were 11 repeat sex offenders who were affected by this oversight in law, meaning that they did not fall within the presumptive prison section of the sentencing guidelines grid. And I brought the grid along today, and I'm holding the sex offender grid in my hand here. And we're talking about the shaded area of the grid where the guidelines recommend probation normally, and above that dispositional line in the white area of the grid is a prison recommendation. So these 11 offenders between 2007 and 2009 fall within this presumptive probationary section. Four of them did receive prison sentences through a upward dispositional departure that was imposed by the judge. And I'm happy to try and answer any of your technical questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a question on your fiscal note. It said, my understanding was that there'd be two beds the first year, and then was it five the next year, and then six the following year. I would think since it's going up, that if there's a three-year minimum, there would be more than six in the third year. I thought my understanding was that there would be six additional in the third year, but the first two, since there's a three-year minimum, would still be in, wouldn't they? So that you'd be adding those rather than of the seven from the first 2 years, six of those are getting out? That doesn't seem possible, but that's what your fiscal note says, according to our staff.
Ms. Payne, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulgrew. There is the impact does not occur immediately. And so what we're projecting is in the first, in that 2013, there would be those two people, and then the following year there would be five beds needed, and then every year after there would be six beds each year after.
So, Mr. Chairman, then what the fiscal note says isn't correct then? Well, we can work this out later, but the fiscal note, according to our staff, is not correct then. Because that's what I was wondering about, how you could lose people when you've got a three-year minimum. It didn't seem possible to be letting people out in less than 3 years.
Ms. Payne?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mullery, I don't believe that's the intention of the final fiscal note. I saw a draft of the note, and so we can certainly go back to our office and take another look at that. Thank you.
Of course, whatever on is less. Scientific. No. All right, representatives. No, there aren't any. Any questions, any more testimony or closing comments?
No other testimony. Just want to let the chairman know I am appreciative of you recognizing the importance of this bill, and I'm appreciative of the bipartisan support for this bill as well. And thank you so much.
Okay. Without any more comments or questions, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative McDonald. What's going on tomorrow? And Representative Smith, House File 933. Representative Smith, are you ready to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I am. I would move House File 933 and that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance.
Okay, Mr. Representative Smith has moved House File 933. It's before us. And Representative Smith, you have any opening comments?
Mr. Chairman, I do. I have with me Melissa Reed, who is employed by the Minneapolis Government Relations Division, and I'm going to ask her to walk through the bill and provide testimony as to the reasons why this bill is needed. But basically, the bill changes prostitution law in Minnesota by clarifying the meanings of patron and prostitute and adding the acts of the patron to the definition of prostitution. Also, the other day, a few days ago, we dealt with a so-called safe harbor bill in this committee, and it's a problem with the issue of juvenile prostitutes, in other words, those under 18. Society considers it a societal problem in that many, if not most, of the participants are unwilling and indeed victim of trafficking, and this bill addresses that as well, and I'd like Ms. Reed to pick it up from there.
Welcome, Ms. Reed, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, for the committee, my name is Melissa Reed, and I'm a government relations representative with the City of Minneapolis. And I think what we have before you today is a fairly straightforward, simple bill. What we are attempting to do with this piece of legislation is disentangle what we consider to be kind of a tangled prostitution statute, the way that it's currently drafted. We're not making any substantive changes to law. We're not increasing penalties or changing any charging. We're just trying to disentangle this section of law. The way that the prostitution statute is currently drafted, whether someone is arrested and charged as a patron or as a prostitute, they're charged under the same subdivision of law. And so when we're trying to pull data to understand how many prostitutes versus how many patrons have been arrested and charged, the only way to differentiate between those two currently is to do a manual search through law enforcement records. So by disentangling them and simply giving them separate and distinct subdivisions, we're just going to be able to pull the data a lot more efficiently and effectively. What that will accomplish is it will allow local law enforcement to have a much better idea about what's going on in our communities in terms of the number of arrests of patrons, the number of arrests for prostitutes. So it will allow us to deploy our resources more efficiently and more strategically, because we really will have a more up-to-date, accurate understanding about the number of these arrests. The second thing it will allow us to do is to be in better compliance with the 2008 federal human trafficking legislation, which is the Wilberforce Act. That 2008 legislation required that states report differentiated statistics for traffickers, patrons, and prostitutes. Human trafficking language that was passed by this legislature in 2009 successfully addressed the first category of allowing us to provide differentiated statistics for traffickers. We think that this bill will help us address those last two points and help us have separate data for prostitutes and for patrons. And the only thing I would like to add is that this bill has been unanimously endorsed by the state's Human Trafficking Task Force, and you can see on the bottom of the fact sheet before you the list of several other organizations that support the legislation. We've been working very closely with Representative Smith and the Family Partnership in particular, and Advocates for Human Rights, as well as a list of other organizations that you see before you. So with that, I would turn it over to the chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. And members, questions so far? The Representative Smith, are you have any other testifiers? Or
Mr. Chairman, I do not.
I don't believe there's any opposition signed up. Any opposition in the crowd? If there's no questions, would you like to restate your motion for your bill or give a closing comment?
Mr. Chairman, this bill in and of itself, like many of the ones we take up, will by itself not save Western civilization from itself, but it is a brick in the foundation. I'd ask for support on this motion to recommend it to pass, re-refer to the House Judiciary Committee.
Okay, Representative Smith has restated his motion. Any questions, comments? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and member.
Representative Gauthier, are you ready to present your bill? Representative Gauthier, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move House File 1043 and recommend passage and re-referral to Judiciary. Mr. Chair, members, before we begin, I believe a fiscal note came in this morning, so I'd like to have Mr. Carger address that.
Okay, we'll probably do that after we move your bill. Yeah. Representative Gauthier moves House File 1043 to recommend it to pass and go to the re-referred to the House Judiciary Policy and Finance. Bill is before us, and Representative Gauthier, you say you'd like Mr. Carger to go over your fiscal note?
Yes, please.
Okay, Mr. Carger.
Mr. Chair, Representative or members of the committee, there is a preliminary note done on the bill, and it is from Corrections and Sentencing Guidelines, and they do say that the beds, there will be an increase in prison beds, two beds in 2012 or 2012, and it goes up to six beds in 2014. Most of them will be state sentences, but they said there will be some prison beds.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, this bill's a straightforward bill about car tampering. It came to me through Chief Ramsey and has a lot of support throughout the state of Minnesota with law enforcement. And basically what it does is aggregate offenses and goes from misdemeanor to gross misdemeanor to felony after four more times of adjudication. I have testifiers of different police departments and organizations, so I'm going to turn that over to Chief Ramsey.
Chief Ramsey, good to have you back. Go ahead and state your title and begin with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gordon Ramsey. I'm the Duluth Police Chief. I'm also the legislative co-chair for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police. This issue is a chief's initiative from the association. With me today is several colleagues. For the sake of brevity, though, we decided that just I would speak to keep things moving. We began talking with chiefs about this issue over the last year or two and found that there's tremendous support and a recognized need for an increased penalty associated with this crime. We estimate that this is probably the most frequent crime that victimizes more of our citizens than likely any other. And it occurs in all neighborhoods and all cities throughout the state. Currently entering an unlocked motor vehicle or a locked motor vehicle is only a misdemeanor. Many states across the country consider this a burglary and classify it as a felony. Over the last few years in Duluth and other parts of the state, we've seen a large increase in the amount of car burglaries. In Duluth alone, it's been 30% since 2007. And since 2000, we've had about 9,000 of these car prowls reported. And we know, because we're tracking these so thoroughly, as you can see in the handout I provided, that the majority of these car prowls are committed by the same offenders. We cited last year about, we had 40 cases that we ultimately made, cited folks for, about 70 individuals totally. We have worked thoroughly with our citizens and our police department through problem-solving and an attempt to reduce the numbers, public awareness education, developed a database on the suspects, directed patrol, increased signage at parks, utilization of cameras and surveillance, sting operations, increased our citizens patrol to over 400. Despite all these efforts, we continue to see a common theme that those we cite for this crime is that the risk is worth the reward. And this comes at a cost, not only in fiscal cost to cities, by our police officers having to spend this extra time on these cases, but also our citizens, both financially and through their overall feelings of safety. Our community members are tired of being victimized by this crime, and at several community meetings in the last year or so, I've been asked by the citizens, what are we doing about this crime? When we stopped the prowl suspects in several cases, one of them told us that when we asked them what they were doing out, they looked at us and said, well, you know what we're doing. In another one of our sting operations, we got a couple of car burglars in action, and when we handcuffed them and told them they were going to jail, they told us, hey, we've only gotten tickets for this before. Likewise, when our citizens have caught suspects in their cars and have called the police and we end up writing the suspect a ticket and sending them walking on their way, the citizens are surprised at the level of this crime as well. Ask any police officer throughout the state, and they'll tell you that it's habitual offenders who are responsible for this crime, and departments across the state have tried time and time again, only to find the offenders know that the penalty is not severe. The handout highlights how thoroughly we track this crime of motor vehicle tampering, and attached is a short newspaper story on how it's affecting our community.
Okay. Thank you, Chief. Representative Gauthier, you had two other testifiers. If it's up to you, if they want to testify in addition and not, we realize that this is happening in their cities and jurisdictions are probably pretty much like theirs, and it is a definite problem. So you could have them testify if you'd like.
But I will defer to them. That's a no.
Okay.
I just do want to point out, Mr. Chair and members, there is a letter from the Director of Public Safety from Mankato, and he cites when he worked in Texas when they did increase penalties that car tampering and prowls went down significantly. I want to reiterate some of the things Chief Ramsey has said. In my neighborhood, the neighborhood patrol, if they spot a car that's not locked, they put a note on it, please lock your car, so on and so forth. And despite best efforts, we continue to see an escalation. so with that, I would like to remove my motion for House File 1043 that it passed and be re-referred to Judiciary unless there's any questions.
Okay. Members, any questions? Any opposition? And thank you for the backup that came, and I did by no means mean to be rude and not let you testify.
We know you have two bills.
We got a few really good bills coming up. So thank you, Representative Gauthier and Chief. It was a very good testimony. Having the, yes. And Representative Gauthier has stated his motion, and you've heard it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Members, I'm going to take the table now for testimony on three of bills that I've authored. They'll all be motion made to be laid over. I think we're going to do the copay first, and then followed by short term, and then the last one. We're waiting for a document to be reproduced on the BCA website post issue. So.
What is?
Okay.
Okay.
We're going to hear testimony on House File 955 first. Representative Cornish, would you like to move the bill?
Yes. The House File 955, here it is. I would move House File 955 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Cornish.
Members, this is the bill that would move the responsibilities for transferring the or the responsibilities of the DOC website on level threes over to the website at the BCA for non-compliant offenders. And we've had a recent interesting fiscal note on this, and Representative Carger, or excuse me, I promoted you again. Mr. Carger, would you, Mr. Chair, would you have Mr. Carger go over the fiscal note?
Mr. Carger, can you go over the fiscal note for us, please?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it is a preliminary note, and the only agency that has completed their part is public safety. And they're saying there basically will be a cost to do this of $110,000 in fiscal year 12 and then $85,000 and then going forward in 13, 14, and 15. Now, the one agency that is not has not completed their part of the fiscal note is corrections, and they may want to come up here and testify. I think they have some they have a response to the bill. So,
okay, Representative Cornish,
Mr. Chair, if I'd like to have my witness testify and. How this transfer would take place and what it would entail, if that would be okay.
Okay, thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Eric Knudsen, special agent in charge of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We're reacting to the request made by the chairman, Mr. Cornish, to take over the Level 3 website from the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections has administered this website for a substantial period of time. Our agency has the ability to administer this program. We have had conversations with the Department of Corrections and how that transfer would take place. We have also consulted with our technical staff at the BCA, and we would be in the process of actually conversion. We have a current non-compliant website at the BCA. The end result of this would be merging the Level 3 website with our current non-compliant website, for the end result having a single predatory offender registration website.
Mr. Chair and members, this actually was just a common sense logical move, I thought, and at first I didn't even project what I thought would be a savings, and it seemed later that there was a savings, so I wanted to include it in the Omnibus Finance Bill, but it seems to make sense when why are there two websites when there could be one, and it sounds like the BCA would be able to handle this website just as efficiently, and then we'd have all the duties in one. I would... As with fiscal notes, we have to take them all with a grain of salt. It seems like some of them are just a scientific, wild, blank guess. And it just seems like this is one of them. And I'm very curious to hear the DOC's response to the fiscal note, how there could not be a savings. But we will hear that in the future. But I'm glad to take any questions if you'd like.
Representative Johnson.
Was the DOC going to, thank you, Mr. Chair, I'll wait till after testimony is completed if there's more coming.
Is there is there someone from the department who would like to testify on this bill?
And please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Bill Donne. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Corrections, Director of the Risk Assessment Community Notification Unit. In that unit, we conduct community notification as well as civil commitment screening and assign risk levels. In terms of this bill, the department takes no formal position on it. We're not supporting nor opposing it. In terms of the question was the fiscal impact is we've always estimated that it takes about one full-time equivalent for us to operate that website. There's currently about 230 offenders on the site, and one of our concerns with the fiscal concern here is the technology systems between DOC and BCA are not compatible, and much of the information on the website is DOC data. And so until and if the systems are compatible, we'll be in a situation where we and DOC will need to gather the DOC data and provide it to BCA manually, which presents a concern for us in terms of resources. As I mentioned, community notification is a much broader task than just the website. And what it involves is every time an offender who's required to register changes his residence, our unit provides a packet of information to law enforcement agencies, those who are receiving the individual as well as those who are leaving it. Just to give you an idea of the workload, in 1997, when this bill was implemented, we had zero community notification files. Today, we have close to 10,000 files. And the increase in resources has not matched that sort of increase in numbers. Last year, 2010, we did over 8,300 address changes, and that number continues to rise. Part of the reason it rises is because most offenders are now required to register for life, and so they're subject to community notification for life, so offenders do not get off this process. And so when we're talking about fiscal impact, the loss of any particular resources would dramatically impact our ability to continue to do the kind of community notification that we're doing.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Donne. So it's basically your belief that doing one less thing would cost more?
Mr. Chair, members, the move of the website to BCA, the way it's currently situated, would not reduce the workload on our unit.
Okay. Representative Mullery.
Well, Representative Johnson, I believe.
Oh, go ahead, Representative Johnson. Yeah. Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess to Representative Cornish, I'm still not clear on what the purpose of this transfer is. If the DOC is doing the, they said they're doing the risk assessments, the monitoring, the notification, it seems to make sense that they'd be dealing with the website as well on this. Can you talk to me a little bit more about what the point is of this?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, this, you know, is a surprise in the turn of events here, because the it was planned to be a savings. I still don't see how it can't be eventually, and so it's a work in progress. We'll be looking at after it's laid over, but it's a very strange set of circumstances, and how, like you say, you can do less duty, and then what's this person going to do now that these duties are taken to the BCA? How can there not be some savings or some big of a cost? So we've got some examination to do there, but the first look at it was efficiencies and duplicity, and the BCA assured us that they could take the transfer of the website, not all the functions, but just the website function. So we'll be looking at this, you know, between now and next Tuesday and working on it and see what went wrong with the original plan here, or our estimations versus theirs. So.
Representative Cornish, this would also provide, for my understanding, for one website for the public to be able to go to, and a little bit less confusing for them as well. Is that correct?
Well, that's what is planned, yes. That was one of the things also. So just a kind of, like I said when I introduced it, it's a common sense logic and lack of, you know, the sense of having two websites.
Representative Johnson, do you have any follow-up? Okay. Representative Mullery.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think it's saying that they're doing less and it costs more. I think that they're saying that they now have to get into a manual mode, which is an enormous additional requirement on work for them. So I can understand why they're saying the fiscal problems. But I'm, and Chair Cornish, I'm concerned about how this affects us in the community. We've got DOC working with now the community officers. They're used to working with the DOC on this, the probation, and I thought I saw the representative of the CCA probation, but not there anymore, apparently left. So I was kind of wondering what they thought of this, because this has a huge effect on them, and I'm just wondering when we're... First of all, I wonder if it's really going to save any money, because we've got all the other things in one department, DOC, and now we're putting more in DPS, which concerns me. But on top of that, I'm just not sure that when you're talking about the probation, the community officers that do the notification, things like that, I think it may, I'm just worried about whether we're going to get as good a coverage for my neighborhoods, because as you know, my neighborhoods in North Minneapolis are either first or second highest in concentration of these people, and so anything that would affect our citizens concerns me a lot.
Well, it's my belief that the, Mr. Chair and members, that the BCA, who already has thousands of people on their website, take care of very well, can assume these duties without any loss of safety to the public. And like I said, we're going to be looking at the fiscal note problem in the next couple of days and examining where our differences lie. So.
Any further questions from the members? This being a public hearing, is there any testifiers that would also like to testify in opposition to or support of the bill? Okay, seeing none, would you like to renew your motion?
Yeah, I'd just like to renew my motion that House File 955 be laid over for possible inclusion in the this finance bill.
Okay. Representative Cornish renews his motion that House File 955 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Thank you.
Let's do the, Mr. Chair, if I could take up the short-term offenders next, so that they've got some long travelers that are going back.
Okay. Representative Cornish, that would be to file House File 1033. Would you like to?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 1033 before us to be laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus finance bill.
Okay, Representative Cornish, to your bill.
Members, this is a fairly simple but yet controversial bill. Admittedly, this has been done once before, where for terms of less imprisonment than 180 days, they shall be committed to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections and must serve the remaining term of imprisonment as a workhouse, work farm, or county jail. What this does is the short-term offenders would be moved to the county jails, and let Mr. Carter go over the fiscal note, if he would.
Mr. Carter.
If he would.
Mr. Carter, to the fiscal note.
Members of the committee, by doing this in House File 1033, it has a savings to the state in the first biennium of about $5.7 million, and then in the next biennium it goes up to about a little over $8.8 million. However, the way the bill is right now, there is no reimbursement for the counties for these individuals.
Yes.
And I should point out that we just received some information from the Department of Corrections on the number of short-term offenders, and let me just go over this. For 1 month or less, there were these people staying 1 month or less in prison.
Mr. Chair, the reason I want to interrupt is it would really help if we could quickly run copies of this, because this is a detailed note, and it's pretty hard to follow as he's talking.
Mr. Carter, did you have a comment to that?
We can... Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, we can run copies on this. I think it should be on the website, too, and Evidently, it was not put in the packets.
It was not in the packet.
It's probably my mistake for not giving it to the...
I understand it's not on the website, and if we're trying to follow...
Sure.
This would
we'll make some copies.
Sure. Thank you.
To that, then, let's continue discussion until we get copies of that, Representative Cornyn.
Okay, why don't we bring the testifiers in opposition to the bill up, if you would, if there's no questions right to begin with, and hear from them, and then we can maybe go over the fiscal note once the copies are made.
Okay. And please state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Nancy Schuweiler. I'm a Dakota County Commissioner. I'm chair of our legislative committee, and I'm also here speaking on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and MICA. We are in opposition of this proposal that would recreate the short-term offender program and have this group of offenders serve time in county facilities without compensation. The short-term offender program is a transfer of state costs and responsibilities onto counties. Based on actual numbers of short-term offenders from the last year of this program, the costs borne by counties of housing these inmates statewide for an entire year will exceed $7 million. In addition to the costs related to the housing and processing of the additional inmates, there will be a corresponding increase in medical and mental health costs involved in the program. The problems this program creates for counties go beyond the financial burden that it imposes. Mr. Franklin will tell you that this population creates heightened security risks, including inmate threats and assaults, increased discipline issues, grievances, staff time to handle investigations, and complaints. Given our experience with the previous iteration of this program, we know that over time there will be a steady growth in the number of offenders that qualify as short-term offenders due to possibility of using the system to avoid prison for a term in the county jail instead. This creates a disincentive to comply with probation conditions, as the threat of prison has a far greater deterrent effect than the threat of jail. Thank you, and I'll stay for questions.
Okay, thank you. Let's hear from the next testifier. Is this to her?
I'll wait till the
end. Okay, thank you. Go ahead. Johnson. Representative Johnson, are you okay if we listen to the rest of the testifiers? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Unfortunately, the two representatives from the sheriffs that we had here had to pull out due to other emergency situations here this morning, so I will pinch hit as best I can. I will just simply indicate to you this is a serious issue for our sheriffs. When we started this program back in 2002-2003, there was a bed shortage in Minnesota, and therefore this plan was put together. We did not have good statistical data information as to the impact it would have on our jails at that time. Obviously, since we have had that point to where we are when the program was terminated a year ago, we have sufficient data to raise concerns. The commissioner has already highlighted, and I will not go into those in great detail unless you would like me to, but these are people that require heightened security. The assaults on our staff and other kinds of things are true. These costs, in addition to the boarding costs, are passed on again to the counties. The increased discipline issues we deal with, the grievance issues we deal with, the lawsuits that we issue, that we deal with, all of those costs come back to the county and just accumulatively add more time to our dwindling resources that we're trying to deal with on our side of the equation with our budgets. The other concern that we have, what we saw, was in the court process, people would negotiate pleas of less than a year so they could spend time in the jail. And we saw not only offenders with probation violations, but we saw the court process, and I hate to use the word manipulated, but the word would be utilized to gain compliance to a plea with a shorter sentence to spend the time in jail. Again, those costs go directly back to the sheriffs. With that, I will just try to summarize very quickly, beyond the cost issue, this has a quality of life issue for our other inmates in the jail, and it has an impact on our staff and their abilities to manage a jail population, which is somewhat different than a prison population. I'll conclude and thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. We're going to go to questions. Still working on the fiscal note. Representative Johnson. Representative Mulray.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Either of you, Mr. Franklin, or I forget your name, but the courts have required mental health and drug treatment in the prisons. Is that also true of these short-term incarcerations in jails?
Mr. Franklin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulray, that is true. Mental health issues in our jail are probably our number one problem. Number two, the cost of medications for these inmates is extremely high. Unfortunately, many of the inmates that find themselves incarcerated are off their medications when they commit a crime, come into the facility, and the humane thing is to try to bring them back into compliance with their medications and stabilize them. All of that is a direct cost. In addition to those things, while we have them, if a jail is full, and I will use Stearns County as my example, they daily are full. If they have STOs in there and they have a surgence of other daily populations, they have to then board those out. So they have to take those other inmates from the daily business and transport those to other jails around the state. All of those costs of transportation, etc., are borne by Stearns County. So dealing with the mental illness issues is a big issue. It's an important issue. It's something we must address. And there are strings and attachments that ripple over into other daily operational businesses that have costs, again, directly associated to the counties.
Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up, that's a huge concern to me because from the past few years, we've learned that 60-80% of those incarcerated have mental health and or drug needs for treatment. And I think there's a lot of counties in this state probably don't have near as good a treatment capacity as the prison system, for one thing, and another thing is the cost, and I'm afraid that we're going to have a lot of people not put into incarceration that should be for a while, both for purposes of deterrence and also for treatment. They need to be in, and I'm afraid judges might not be putting them in, plus the problem of them not getting the treatment they need. So I'm very concerned about where this is going.
Mr. Chair, if I
yes,
may.
Yes, Michelle Weiler, go ahead.
Thank you. Our county board over a number of years have had to have budget amendments to the jail budget because of medication costs. And my husband happens to be a pharmacist. So when I got the board paper the first time about the increased cost of psychotropic meds for inmates in our jails, I asked him, what on average is the cost of psychotropic meds? And he said they can range from $50 to $1,000 per pill. Per pill. So we have routinely had to have budget amendments to cover those costs for inmates in our jail, whether they were short-term offenders or inmates that were supposed to be in the Dakota County Jail as a county inmate. And we've gone as much as $500,000 over our planned budget to cover those expenses.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, and Mr. Franklin, for your testimony. Just to reaffirm a couple of things. One is that it is an unfunded mandate that is a huge problem for the counties. Ramsey County, in 2009, estimated cost them well over $1 million to house their short-term offenders. So at a time when we're looking at cutting county program aid and LGA and the like, it just doesn't make any sense. The second thing I would note is that it truly is a different type of inmate. I mean, it's all on a continuum, but these are the more difficult type of inmates. The last 5 years I worked at the Ramsey County Jail, I was the hearing discipline officer, and the short-term offenders that we dealt with were by and large involved in much more assaultive, egregious types of behavior that required much more staff time and much more problems within the facility. So that those two aspects make this bill very, I think, problematic and not worth moving forward.
Mr. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Justice. Yeah, it's interesting to get different perspectives as we hear on this particular issue. Is there any type of amendments or comfort language that could be added to the bill that would address your concerns, for instance, that the state would pay the per diem rate to you, or do you just see this as a totally unworkable scenario?
Mr. Chair, if I may. I see it as unworkable because in Dakota County we are already over capacity, and so we are already incurring the expenses of boarding out, which not only do we have to pay the rate of whichever jail will accept our inmates, but we also have incurred transportation costs and, of course, the additional medical expenses, which are above what the per diem rate is. So I see this as still a very huge burden on the local property taxpayer.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead,
Mr. Chairman,
Franklin.
If I might address this in an attempt to be conciliatory, there are potentially, let me make 2 points. There are potentially jails in the state that potentially may be able to provide a service if a contractual type arrangement could be made that would benefit both the county of record that may have bed space available and the state. However, the savings that you are looking for probably is not as great as what you are looking for, but it may, number one, produce something that's workable in our criminal justice system. Point two, Representative Mullery hits on, I think, one of the most difficult points. We as sheriffs in jails, and especially smaller jails, cannot provide the appropriate mental health services and programming that you can in a secured facility like a prison, where you maintain a larger facility and have those programming needs. It's a humane issue of trying to better people that I think we get wrapped around the axle trying to solve. That being said, if there are jails in the state that are of size and could provide those programming kinds of things in a concerted effort to work with the DOC, there may be some room there to work together with those county boards that find that agreeable. But again, it would probably not give you the large result of savings that you're looking for.
Representative Grunhagen, follow up.
Just about Representative Cornish. You've heard their concerns. Just appreciate your response.
Representative Cornish.
My response would be that somewhere back in our history, we have decided that the counties can shove us all the prisoners and we just pay for them. They don't have any responsibility. Now, that's a little bit over the edge, but like in the sex offender study, what we found is they pointed the finger at the county attorney, the county, with the huge rate of referrals, not at the judge, but the county attorney. And they're the feeder of the system. So the counties have got the idea now that they send the prisoners, the DOC pays for them, and it's out of their hands. So there's 2 points. And whether you consider this an unfunded mandate or not, I guess I would differ with that a little bit. And so how we look at it in the future, whether it's 180 or 90 or 60 days or whatever, there's some source of responsibility that the counties have to feel, that they can't just ship off a prisoner for 60 days, have the DOC do all the intake, this and that. And yeah, they are bad people, and that's why the county doesn't want them on their roll, to ship them off to the DOC. So we've got 2 points here, one on the far end, one on the near end, where one doesn't have any responsibility to ship it off to the state, and the state wants to put it back and assume some of the responsibility. And so these budget times, so that's my response. So there's two ways to look at that. The counties are feeding the system at the same time, and they would argue that there's been unfunded mandates in the past, and that there's been a, you know, there is a court takeover by the state already that we could talk about. So I guess that would be my response, and this is going to be held over for possible inclusion to work on. So you know, we'll confer with them in the meantime and work on it. But
yeah, thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Representative Mori, are you okay if we go to the fiscal note before you ask your question, or is it to this
I'd
point?
I'd rather go over it and then go to the fiscal note.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Mori.
And it might bring in something. I'm concerned that this is just a huge unfunded mandate, and also that we won't get the necessary treatment for these prisoners. But at the same time, I do agree, this is scary, I agree with Representative Cornish, on there are certain counties that are seemingly overburdening the state system, and maybe we need to, as a state, I think public safety is our number one responsibility, so maybe we have to look at the whole funding system. But I see Mr. Erdman has come in, and I wanted him on the last bill, but at least he's here for this one, and I have a question. Wouldn't this also raise some probation costs for counties?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just to remind people that we are going to recess at noon, and we got another bill, so it's no problem coming back, but if we could be brief, it would be great.
Right. I agree, just, Representative Cornish.
This should be less than a minute, probably, response.
Go ahead. Please state your name for the record.
It can be. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ryan Erdman. I'm the Director and Legislative Liaison for the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. I also work with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And there are probation concerns here, Representative Mullery, to your question. Specifically, many of these people, the way they become a short-term offender is because they have had their probation revoked. And more to the cost concerns is the outcome concern that we would have in corrections, and that being that, as Commissioner Schuweiler mentioned, it's a much greater deterrent effect to have a prison sentence versus a jail sentence hanging over your head. And what we found last time around with this program, as the numbers grew, was that folks would simply allow their sentence to be executed and give no effort to comply with the conditions of probation, because the consequence was only 90, 120, 180 days in the county jail, which they didn't find so objectionable as compared to if it was an actual prison sentence. So again, it's more of a success of probation issue than a cost of probation issue on that end. The costs are mostly borne on the sheriff's side.
To make sure we have time for public testimony, is there anyone here from the public that would like to testify in favor of or in opposition to this bill? Does the Department of Corrections have any thoughts on this as well, or would like to testify? I see a shaking of the head. No? Okay. All right. So I will note, Representative Mullery, that Ms. Larson does have in her notes that you did agree with Representative Cornish. So that will be in the minutes for the next meeting. Mr. Carger, to the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, I believe really I have covered it. I mean, the savings for the first biennium to the state would be $5.7 million, and the next biennium a little over $8.8
million. Representative Kiefer.
Oh, I just like a little clarification. You know, jail, prison, and then there's 180 days. To me, if someone's sentenced for 180 days, they're not, I and you guys are all much more of experts in this area than I am. Just, can I have some clarification of what type of person are we talking about for 180 days? Because it sounds like it's going to be a huge burden on the counties, but at the state level, I don't know. I would like a little clarification on what kind of criminal we're talking about who gets 180 days sentence. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ryan Erdman again, and Representative Kiefer. Very quickly, the person who is sent to prison with less than 180 days to serve typically has had a sentence quite a bit longer, but it's 180 days remaining. They spent some time in jail awaiting trial, maybe 3, 4, 5, even 6 or 7 months. And then during the course of their probation, they had 30 days here and 60 days there in jail as part of intermediate sanctions. And so when you add up all that jail credit, perhaps their 2-year sentence for a property crime of some sort leaves only 180 days remaining when their probation is finally revoked. And so that is actually the primary way that you end up with somebody with a prison sentence of that short a duration, is that calculation of time served.
Okay, thanks.
And so basically what we're saying is these are the these inmates would have been in the jail already, and we're just extending their sentence. So from a safety standpoint, what is we already have a safety issue, period, because these are bad people in jail, correct?
Typically, yes, Mr. Chair, they have typically violated probation. An intermediate sanction of a short time in jail has been imposed. That hasn't been successful. They've violated again, and it's now at that point time to revoke their probation and impose the harsher sentence, because clearly these shorter stints in jail are not the having the deterrent effect that we'd hope for.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Would you, Representative Cornish, would you like to renew your motion?
I would like to just renew the motion that House File 1033 be held over for possible inclusion in the Ombudsman's Finance Bill.
Okay, Representative Cornish renews his motion that the that House File number are we on? Thank you, 1033, be held over for possible inclusion in a later bill. And are we? We've got 5 minutes for the next bill. Should we? Okay, let's head to the next bill. Representative Cornish,
Chair and members would like to move House File 1034 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill. And basically, it's a co-payment of the prisoners at $5 per visit to the health care provider. I think it needs much more explanation than that. In fact, I think we talked about this at length when the Department of Corrections, Nanette, what was her name? Right behind us here. She covered this, I think. And so if there are no questions, if there's anybody who wants to testify in opposition...
Mr. Any member of the public that would like to testify either in opposition to or for this particular bill? And Department of Corrections, I see a shaking of the head no. Okay. Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for the department, probably. My concern is whether, as I've said, I'm very concerned about mental health treatment before they get back into my communities, and because we have probably the heaviest number of reentry, and so would a $5 copayment discourage inmates from seeking mental health care? I'd like to know that, because I definitely don't want that happening. Some neighborhoods in mine have one out of every nine are on felony probation, so.
So now you may please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the Department of Corrections. And this bill only charges copays for offender-initiated health care. So if we have an offender who is getting mental health services and is continuing to be referred back by staff, they would not be charged that $5 copay. Okay. So it would not be a hindrance.
Representative Mullery. No. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, I don't think this is a terrible bill. I just don't see what the point is in it. Could you? Why would we want to put this in statute? You know, maybe it makes more sense to charge $7-$8 later down the road or something. Why do we want to put $5 in statute? Now, if they're already collecting $3, what's the point? I guess is what I'm getting at. Maybe I'm missing it.
Why up the fee?
Why put it in state statute for $5?
Representative Cornish.
And they're already collecting a fee, so we're going to charge them an extra $2. I mean, what?
Mr. Diebel, you want to represent, or Mr. Chair, could you ask Mr. Diebel to answer that?
Yes, I could do that, Representative Cornish. Mr. Diebel, could you to that point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, members, the language, I believe, says at least $5, so it would give them the flexibility to increase it. It's just puts a bottom threshold for the copay.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Diebel, could only go to $5 then?
Mr. Diebel?
Oh, that's the bottom?
Yeah, that, Mr. Chair, Mr. Diebel. Members, the intent was for that to be the minimum amount to be charged.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if the prior witness can come back.
Ms. Larson?
Ms. Larson, thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Larson, I don't want to get too deep into this. I don't know this area at all, but I know that part of our of any healthcare system is not just focused on the individual, but it's also focused on the matter of public health. It's easy to think about when you think about communicable diseases. Would you expect individuals to not come forward because they don't want to forfeit their $5, particularly if they're earning it at 25 cents an hour? That's 10 hours of work. Would you be worried that folks would not come forward to be treated for communicable diseases, thereby putting the rest of the workers and the inmates at risk if we had a scheme like this, or is that not something that we should worry about?
Ms. Flowers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, you know, certainly any kind of implementation of a co-payment is going to have some effect on utilization. But given the fact that this is offender-initiated, the visit to the healthcare provider is assessed, the co-payment, if it's offender-initiated. If one of our staff were to see somebody that's ill, we would have, the staff person would refer them to health services. So in the instance of a communicable disease, if you see somebody that's, you know, having a productive cough in that respect, you know, potentially tuberculosis, we would certainly have the staff person refer them to health services. So it's not as much of a concern. It's not as much of a concern to me with communicable diseases as it might be for other things that are less visible for that than that, that could exacerbate into something a little bit more expensive.
Representative
Mr. Chair and Ms. Larson, perhaps on that point, as Representative Cornish continues to work on this bill, it might be wise to specify that. It seems to me that there's, you know, always a possibility for professional error or just lapse, you know, and then you've got, you know, the potential for a real problem to occur within a very contained population, and all sorts of other folks wind up paying the price for an inmate not coming forward, or in this case, someone not, you know, for whatever reason, being able to make a proper diagnosis in time. So perhaps, Representative Cornish, you might want to think about some kind of, as you push forward, some kind of specific carve-out here in this regard. I don't think it's your intent to put anyone else within the prison population, including the workers, at risk for enhanced spreading of communicable diseases.
Representative Hilty, the 12 o'clock question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Larson, I'm reading the fiscal note, the savings to the state of $35,000 as a result of this. I haven't found it. It appears that the savings is just predicated on the assumption that the additional $2 will be multiplied by 17,347 offenders. Was there any consideration in the fiscal note? I presume one of the reasons for co-pays is that it's meant to deter people from seeking medical help. And is there any consideration in the fiscal note about savings to the program in providing these services as a result of deterring people from seeking assistance?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, we did include an assumption that there would be probably a 5% decrease in offender-initiated encounters as a result of the increased copay. That's not a significant enough decrease for it to decrease our staff workload.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're going to hold over House File 1034 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And as an announcement, we will not be meeting this evening, so our next meeting will be on Thursday, 10:15 in this room. This meeting is adjourned.